Awakened. The apocalyptic survival story based on the writings of Greg Bilderback. Starring Greg Bilderback, Joseph Donald Mack, Amaya Bilderback, and Kevin Crowe. Chapter 1. Though it has been some time now, I can still remember it as clearly as if it were yesterday. It was a typical Tuesday morning. The alarm went off at 5:15 a.m., just as it had every other weekday for as long as I could remember. I quickly slapped the snooze button and turned to the other side, as though somehow turning my back to the alarm would make it go away. Of course it did not. So 7 minutes later, I begrudgingly dragged myself out of bed and headed to the shower. Standing with my head against the shower wall, I let the warm water trickle over me, hoping it would wake me from my catatonic slumber. At some point during the shower, my wife cracked open the bathroom door and let the dog in. Lyra was only 7 or 8 months old back then and was quite restless in the morning, so my wife would often let her in the bathroom while I was showering so she could go back to sleep. The silly black lab poked her sleek muzzle past the curtain to lap the mist as it ricocheted off my skin, her silly puppy dog eyes gazing up at me, waiting for me to get out and give her some breakfast.
1, 2, 3, motivated.
I muttered aloud as I turned off the water and struck the diverter lever, letting the last of the water drain out of the faucet into the tub. I toweled off and scuffled into the den adjacent to the bathroom. The room glowed royal blue from the LED lights in the face of the stairs leading up to the living room. My bare feet, still moist from the shower, slapped the glossy hardwood floors like the flippers of a beach seal as I sleepily made my way to the front door to let the dog out. I stood in the doorway freezing as the frigid winter air struck my shirtless torso like a freight train.
My God!
I groaned.
It must be like 15 degrees out this morning. Shit.
Lyra, get over here. Let's get you some breakfast. She scampered up the porch and through the front door. Her damp feet pattered across the floor of the kitchen over to her bed, where she sat eagerly eyeing me and licking her lips.
Your favorite time of the day, isn't it, girl?
I inquired rhetorically, fully aware that no audible answer was coming. I filled her dish, and she devoured it all as fast as I could turn and head to the bedroom to dress. I pulled on my jeans, grabbed a t-shirt, and quietly closed the door behind me so as not to disturb my sleeping beauty. As I sat on the bench to put on my socks, I could see the headlights of Donald's car sputtering into the driveway. Lyra anxiously stood at the front door, staring intensely through the glass, awaiting Donald's big, bald head to appear on the front steps. Donald was an engineer at the firm where I worked, just like me, but extremely intelligent, and he knew it. We had been carpooling together ever since things dissolved between him and his wife. He was a good man, with good intentions, but a bit eccentric to say the least, and highly opinionated. He was a little older than myself, maybe 10 years or so, but from the piercings that adorned his ears and tongue, you would think he might have been clinging to the last vestiges of his youth a little too tightly. His puffy fake leather jacket, combined with the flaps of his untied combat boots and crumpled pant legs shoved down into them, made him quite the sight. I remember the first time my daughter saw him. On the way home, she said,
"Daddy, that guy's awesome! His boots have wings!"
Donald stood awkwardly on the porch, waiting for me to open the door. As I cracked the front door open, Lyra bull-rushed Uncle Donnie as she did every morning. Something tells me that though it was bad manners on her part, Donald looked forward to that greeting every morning just as I did when I came home from work every night.
"Oh, good doggy,"
he praised as he lathered her with attention.
"You're a good little doggy, aren't you?"
I handed Donald the keys as I turned towards the bathroom to go brush my teeth.
"Here, make yourself useful. Go start that truck. It's freezing out there."
He bobbed his hairless noggin up and down a couple of times, signaling he agreed as he turned and headed down the steps and back out to the truck. I took that time to brush my teeth, knowing that as soon as Donald returned, he would stand in the bathroom doorway while I brushed, rather than wait for me in the kitchen like a normal person would do. I spit in the sink, took a quick gargle, and placed my toothbrush back on the charger. By that time, Donald was lumbering back into the foyer, and like a lost puppy dog, he began to follow my steps back and forth across the house as I prepared my lunch, grabbed my phone and my wallet. I snuck into my little girl Amy's room to give her a quiet peck on the cheek and whisper in her ear,
"Daddy loves you, baby. Have a good day at school."
Then it was off to the bedroom for the last of my morning routines. I leaned over my sleeping bride and softly kissed her forehead as I did every day. I kissed her several times and then tried to sneak one in on the lips.
"Get away from me,"
she grumbled, but I persisted. She giggled a little and whispered,
"You must really love me. Kiss me this early in the morning. You know I stink."
"But I love you, baby," I answered. "I'll see you tonight. Have a good day, Johnny." I called Lyra into the bedroom and up onto the bed with Johnny. "Lay down, girl. Don't be restless and annoying for Mama." She cozily curled up in her little doggy cubby of blankets, and I turned to close the door behind me, just as our fat cat, Kitty Stupid, as we called her, let out a meow and nestled into the blankets with the dog beside her. At that time, I had no idea how bad I would want to see them all again, or how hard it would be for me to make that happen. Donald and I headed out the front door, killing the lights behind us, and made our way to the truck. I threw my lunch pail in the back seat and scuffled over to the barn. I grabbed a few leaves of hay and a half a tin of grain for each of the two horses. Both horses were getting up there in age, so we had to feed them a little more than normal due to the unusually cold weather streak we were in the middle of. Western Washington didn't typically reach the teens in temperature, and when it did, it didn't usually last weeks long like it had this time. Nikita, the alpha of the two, shoved Taffy back as the first leaf of hay and grain hit the feeder. She buried her snout deep into the pile and tossed the alfalfa about carelessly. Taffy kept trying to nose in, but Nikita was having none of it. After tossing the second leaf and accompanying half tin of grain into the feeder for Taffy, I grabbed the sledge to break the frozen water in their trough.
"Won't last long, girls. Drink while you can. It'll be frozen before Amy and Mama get up."
I arrived back at the truck, and the windows were still glazed over with the morning frost.
"Why didn't you scrape the windows, dude? We're gonna be late. You just been sitting here? What the fuck?"
I grabbed the ice scraper out of the front door tray and cleared a small patch to see through. As I climbed back into the truck, Donald retorted,
"That's way more effort than I would put in. I just normally wait for the defroster to take care of it."
"There's no time for that," I fired back. "We're 15 minutes behind, man. Are you really that lazy?"
Donald looked down somberly.
"You have no idea how bad I'm struggling with motivation these days, you know, since it all..."
He trailed off, staring out the window as we made our way down the driveway.
"I know, buddy. I'm sorry. One thing I can promise you, though, things will change. They always do. Your circumstances, your likes, your dislikes, your situation, it always changes. That's just how life is. You'll get through it eventually. Things always change."
"I know, Greg, but I'm just not there yet."
I felt bad for Donald. He was trying to do right by his wife, but for some reason she wasn't showing any mercy. She was taking him for all he had, feeling entitled to it. It wasn't really my business to get involved, and I know Donald wasn't perfect, but he tried for those kids, something their biological fathers certainly weren't doing. He gave those kids more stability than they had ever known, but for some reason it wasn't good enough for her, and she was unremorsefully making him pay the price. It struck me as unfair because Donald was one of the most generous people I had ever even known. We made our way through the Key Peninsula, across the bridge at the Spit, and onto the highway. It was quiet that morning. Though Donald wasn't a big fan of the radio, I was experimenting with the idea of making him listen to it with me. Being the only man in a house full of ladies, sometimes I just needed a break from conversation. We listened to the local sports radio program as they talked about our football team's greater-than-ever chances to take the championship that year. Though I wasn't aware at the time, it kind of figured that the first time in 36 years my team would have a legitimate shot at winning a title, that the game would never be played. I guess looking back, I would have so many more important things to deal with that it really wouldn't matter. But it is still an ironic example of the kind of luck I'd always had. I can remember being irritated by Donald's flippant remarks about the football team. I'm fairly certain that the only two games he had ever watched in his life were with me, so I really didn't give any credence to his opinions on sports. I guess I should have, because by some mystery or miracle, Donald was winning the pigskin pick'em pool at the office, which I also found irritating, because he would always joke about getting the answers from the psychic hotline. We knew he was full of it, but regardless of where he was getting his information, he was correct more often than the rest of us. What Donald lacked in sports knowledge, he made up for in lots of other areas. He had military experience with explosives, he was an engineering mastermind that made even the smartest of men feel stupid, and he knew how to make anything out of anything, if you know what I mean. He was an encyclopedia of knowledge, from history and politics to music and movies. Speaking of movies, he was a ridiculously huge fan of superhero movies, so much so that he once wore a shirt with a cape to work. He would never live that one down. He was a constitutional conservative, as well as a bit of a doomsday prepper. He had a concealed carry permit, and he packed a pistol with him just about everywhere he went. I liked that about him, because I myself was a conspiracy theorist. I thought for sure that when the end of times came, it would be all black helicopters and napalm, some Illuminati global elitist shit. Little did I know. I was so naive. I turned down the radio during a commercial break. Donald was rambling on about the chemical differences between paint thinner and nail polish remover, and I was only half listening. Something about methyl ethyl ketone. I'm not really sure because I was distracted by a news update that came on between the segments of the radio show. The lady was saying something about an outbreak of illness at a local elementary school causing several of the faculty members and a majority of the students to get very sick, and they weren't really sure what the cause was. Though I didn't think too much of it, it did seem peculiar enough to gain my notice. We pulled into the parking lot of the electric utility engineering firm. Ice melt sprinkled all across the parking lot, sparkling in the glow of the sodium lights. I took my usual spot, grabbed my lunch, locked the truck, and trekked across the parking lot with Donald by my side. He was still blathering on about some backwoods method of extracting nitrates from manure and mixing it with diesel fuel to make explosives. Some real homegrown terrorist shit. I remember reaching for my badge to open the door leading to the office. Just as the badge reader beeped, unlocking the door, a convoy of green army-style M35 deuce-and-a-half transport vehicles motored down Milwaukee Avenue towards the fairgrounds. It didn't really hit me how unusual that was until I stepped into the hallway and headed towards my desk. There was a peculiar amount of bustling around by the management staff, and it seemed kind of hushed as they tried to keep their hallway discussions on the down low. I rounded the corner to my padded cell known as a cubicle to see Evan standing across the room with his head flicking side to side as though he were watching a tennis match. He was watching managers shuffle in and out of the office, zigzagging frantically to and from all corners of the building. A second later, I saw two uniformed soldiers and an officer escorting the base manager back to his office. "What the fuck is this all about?" I asked. Evan shrugged his shoulders, indicating my guess was as good as his. Evan was a funny kid. He was probably 10 years or more younger than myself, and he'd only been with the firm for about 8 or 9 months. He was a contract employee at first, and only recently had been hired by the company. Now that he was officially a full-time employee, he was eligible for overtime on storm duty. I assume he was watching the hustle and bustle with the anticipation of collecting a fat overtime check, should all of this be related to some power outage or something else due to the cold weather snap we were in the midst of. "Where's Brian?" I inquired. "You seen him yet today?" Just as I said his name, Brian's head popped up over the cubicle wall like a whack-a-mole. Brian, our supervisor, had one of those faces that reminded me of a Joker's smile. Tall, skinny guy. Only a year or two older than Evan, but due to his ambitious nature, he had done quite well for himself in that short of an amount of time. He was quite a bit more reserved than the rest of our group, the kind of guy who couldn't wait to live like an old person. He could still have a little fun, though, and that's what made our group so successful. He was a spendthrift, and we all made fun of his tendency to turn other people's trash into his treasure. But he would also give a stranger the shirt off his back if they needed it. Brian was a good guy, just a bit of a company guy, if you know what I mean.
"Greg, I need to talk to you for a second, in private,"
instructed Brian.
Okay, everything all right?"
I asked. Brian just waved me in the direction of the empty office next to the coffee urn, and I followed obediently. As we passed Donald's cube, he stood up and shouted,
"Well, Brian, looks like the network is running so slow that I can't even get a license to log into my CAD account. This office and its ridiculous excuse for a utility internet network are the biggest obstruction to productivity. Next to you, that is."
Brian stopped only for a second to humor Donald's remarks. Donald stood in the entry to his cube, legs spread about shoulder width, both hands out at his sides, preparing to give a lecture on the lack of resources the company had provided him.
"Not now, Donald,"
scolded Brian as he proceeded to the empty office across from the dispatch center and closed the door behind me. Before I could even sit down, Brian started in.
"I think I remember you telling me that when you worked for the Transit Authority, you had some FEMA training. Is that right?"
"Yeah, I did,"
I answered cautiously.
As a conspiracy theorist, I was super leery of anything to do with government-sponsored emergency camps. There was just something about the idea of the National Guard herding civilians into concentration camps for their own good that didn't sit quite well with me. I also had some when I worked on Navy cranes for the Department of Defense. But why the hell would you even be asking me that? I questioned. Brian, typically straight-laced and ready to please his superiors, was a little more trusting of authority than myself. He wouldn't question orders like I probably would, and that's why he was a supervisor and I was a worker.
I'm not sure exactly what's going on,
he started.
But those of us with FEMA training are being instructed to report to the National Guard at the fairgrounds in Puyallup. Some of the staff is being sent to monitor the grid, and the rest are going to the fairgrounds in those M35s to register as civilians.
What the hell is going on? Is there some kind of storm? Is Mount Rainier expected to erupt? Why the hell would we be asked to do that?
Like I said, I don't know for sure. I was just told myself a few minutes ago by the VP of the firm that I was to find anyone with FEMA certifications and take them down to the fairgrounds. I have the certification, Kenny has his, Glenda and a few others have theirs, but I just remembered you telling me that you had one from your light rail days too. That's all I know right now.
Brian pushed past me and opened the office door.
Let's go,
he said.
Fuck that,
I muttered to myself under my breath as I followed Brian out the door. I went back to my desk and pretended to be fumbling for my keys or something and quickly turned on the desktop radio, tuning into the first news station I could think of. The reports were pretty shocking. Some kind of flu-like illness was quickly spreading across the state. Schools, offices, public transit, and any other large places of gathering you could think of were already reporting infections. There were staff members, students, customers, all collapsing in their tracks from strangely intense fever-like symptoms. Attempts to quarantine the infected were already in progress all over the state.
Donald, this is fucking crazy. Are you hearing this shit?
Donald's head popped up over the cubicle wall as he glanced left and right, suspiciously eyeing the commotion around us. He leaned forward and whispered,
Dude, I know you guys all think I'm crazy when I say stuff like this, but we might want to consider getting the fuck out of here before the shit hits a fan.
Do you have that FEMA training? I asked. Donald shook his head no.
I was just told to follow everyone else from the office into the parking lot to check into the National Guard at the trucks. They're loading people into those deuce and a halfs and taking them to the fairgrounds to be examined. I'm not liking the sound of that at all, dude.
Me either. And on top of that, Brian just told me I'm supposed to report to the fairgrounds to assist in checking people in, because I have that stupid training from back in my transit days. It was right then that it first occurred to me that my little girl was already at school by now. Shit, dude, we should try to sneak out of here. My little girl's at school. You remember that radio report this morning while we were talking about the schools? What if Amy's school's infected too? I can't just leave her there, especially if the National Guard's rounding up children there too. I could only imagine how scared she would be, all alone in a situation like that. Donald seemed totally on board with ignoring the National Guard's instructions to muster in the parking lot. We both didn't want to load into those M35s and be carted off to some camp. We needed to find a way to sneak out of the office and hit the road before it was too late. I grabbed my phone and tried calling my wife several times with no answer. She worked late at night as a bar manager, so it wasn't abnormal for her to sleep with her phone ringer off in the mornings to avoid being disturbed. After a few attempts with no luck, I sent her a text message summarizing what was going on and urging her to get down to the school and get Amy home before the middle school was infected or locked down and we were all separated. I called Amy's phone too, but I didn't have any luck there either. I texted her asking if everything was okay and told her to hold on and that I was coming for her. Donald was also on the phone trying to reach his stepson back home on the peninsula. I remember feeling momentarily relieved when my phone buzzed in my pocket and I saw my daughter's name. The feeling of relief was short-lived once I read the message.
Daddy, I'm scared. Everyone is getting sick. My friends, the teachers, even the bus drivers.
My heart sunk to my belly as I texted back, asking if she felt sick also. It seemed like an eternity until my phone vibrated again with her answer.
I feel fine, but I'm really scared. And they want us all to get back on the bus, but they're not school buses. Daddy, what do I do?
All I could think of was to tell her to find some place to hide, so I did. Find an empty classroom, the bathroom, the janitor's closet, anywhere. Whatever you do, just don't get on that bus. I'm coming for you, I promise. The office was a good hour and 15 minutes away from the middle school on a normal day. I had no idea how difficult it would be for me to keep that promise or how long I was going to leave her waiting there.
By that time, the parking lot was already full of a mix of employees' cars, company vehicles, and military transport vehicles. Soldiers were coming into the office and beginning the process of taking roll call and collecting everyone's information. If we were going to get out of there, we were going to have to do it fast and stealthily. Donald decided to check the loading dock area where the line construction crews mustered every morning to see if we could sneak out that way. I wasn't a huge fan of the idea, as the yard by the loading dock was fenced and gated, and it seemed like a better way to get trapped than to escape. With all the commotion in the office, and the emphasis on getting everyone gathered up and herded into those transporters in the parking lot, it might have been our only chance. It was while I was waiting for Donald to return with the all clear for the back door that I had my first encounter with the infected. Glenda came around the corner on her way to the women's restroom, her sweaty forehead gleaming in the reflection of the cheap 70s fluorescent lighting like an oil-slick road after the first rain.
Jesus, girl, are you okay?
I asked as she stumbled past me, trying to mask her symptoms from her co-workers and the onlooking soldiers. Her eyes met mine, bloodshot red as if she had spent the last 8 hours taking bong hits and smoking cigars in a car with the windows rolled up. Which probably wouldn't have been that out of character for her.
Whoa.
I thought to myself, or maybe I said it out loud. I'm not really sure which, and I guess it doesn't really matter. I backed away from her as she passed, so I'm sure even if I didn't say it out loud, it must have been clear what I was thinking. Seconds later, Donald returned, informing me that we could probably get out through the dock, but it might be hard to get out of the gate unless we hid out until the transports left. Glenda's profuse coughing could be heard in the hallway outside the ladies' room. Two soldiers escorted a group of medical personnel in biohazard suits to the door of the restroom.
In here. She went in here,
said one of the soldiers. They waited outside, placing rubber gloves and breathing masks on as the two other medical personnel entered the bathroom. You could hear the scuffle of Glenda's resistance as they tried to detain her. She was screaming. Between bouts of whooping coughs, garbage cans were clanging against the wall and you could hear the slap of her hands against the stall doors as they wrestled her to the bathroom floor. The two uniformed soldiers with breathing masks and rubber gloves on followed inside to help out. They emerged from the restroom with Glenda in their arms, thrashing about like a great white shark. She was screaming while coughing bloody chunks of what looked like her lungs all over herself and her captors. Everyone in the office just froze as they watched the soldiers carry Glenda out the front door and around the corner of the parking lot. I looked over my shoulder at Donald and Evan, whose pale faces stared speechlessly back at me. This was clearly no ordinary flu virus. Seconds later, the silence was broken by the sound of a single gunshot fired somewhere in the parking lot. Someone in the office shrieked aloud, only to be ordered to silence by one of the uniformed soldiers. They began to line our co-workers up single file along the hallway leading to the front door. I made my way over to where Evan and Donald were standing.
Looks like it's now or never, gentlemen. Evan, you got a plan? I gotta get to my dad's place. It's secluded, he's got some guns and shit. I should be safe there.
We heard some shuffling in the cube around the corner. Alex, the admin, was collecting some personal things and placing them in her bag. Alex was in her mid to late 20s, and she was pregnant with her first child. Alex was a cute, yet tough young lady with thick skin and a good sense of humor, which she needed in order to survive in a work group like ours. In this moment, however, there was no humor to be found.
Alex, I don't think you should go with them to the fairgrounds with your baby and all. Is your husband home? Can you get back to him?
I asked.
I can't reach him. All I get is a busy signal. Guys, I'm scared.
Evan volunteered to get her home on his way back to his dad's place. Our first order of business, however, was to figure out how to get out of the office and onto the road. As the soldiers moved up and down the line that was forming in the hall, a few more of our co-workers began to cough and show signs of possible infection.
This one here, take him,
ordered one soldier to another. Two more soldiers grabbed Scott by the arms and began to drag him towards the door.
Fuck you!
Shouted Scott as he ripped his arms free and took off towards the lunchroom. He was tackled to the floor by two more soldiers I didn't even know were in the building. They pulled his arms behind him like a perpetrator on Cops and zip-tied his wrists together. He kicked and screamed as they tried to restrain him. Again, the coughing and more blood. One of the soldiers zip-tied him at the ankles, but he kept writhing in his fevered resistance.
Ah, shit! This motherfucker bit me!
Exclaimed one of the soldiers as he struck Scott with his flashlight just at the base of the neck. The soldier jerked back and let go of Scott's arm, dropping the flashlight to the ground, and he rolled up his shirt sleeve. A small trickle of blood could be seen rolling down his forearm like a crimson drop of rain. His eyes fearfully glared at his cohorts as they continued their struggle to restrain Scott.
Shit. Oh shit. Oh shit. This is not good. This is not good.
He kept repeating as he dropped to his knees in the hallway. Scott's jaws clamped down again on the shoulder of another soldier, and as he went into a crocodilian death roll, we could see his eyes roll back. They were a reddish-white mixture of bloodshot and milky glaze, with the soulless emptiness of a rabid animal. The soldier screamed out in a combination of pain and fear as he wrestled to free himself from the enraged yoke of Scott's clenched jaws. I had never seen a human act so instinctually carnal, with the crazed intensity of a caged fight dog. It was startling how powerful he was, as I had never thought of Scott as a very athletic or physically intimidating man, yet he was a formidable challenge for the soldiers attempting to suppress his violent struggle. Amidst the pandemonium of Scott's intemperate defiance, I saw our opportunity to evade the detection of our would-be captors. While the entire office was shrieking and bellowing in disbelief over the scene, Alex, Evan, Donald, and I smuggled ourselves surreptitiously towards the stairs by the dock. We were rounding the corner just before the stairs when I took one last look at the bedlam that lay behind us. More soldiers and hazmat troopers began to not only assist in detaining Scott, but also the two bitten soldiers. It was absolute madness back there. We hit the stairs and impelled through the door single file out onto the loading dock. We didn't see any other employees outside at first, so we moved quickly to the end of the dock and down the stairs into the yard. As we reached the edge of the dumpsters, we could see the soldiers forcing all the civilians into the convoys of M35s. Some willfully complied with the order, others only cooperated out of fear. I suppose the display inside was quite a motivator to do as told. The bitten soldiers and several more of our co-workers were being forcefully loaded into some sort of biohazard quarantine vehicle by the hazmat troopers.
Brooks, Clemson, go sweep the building and the yard. Make sure we're not leaving anyone behind,
ordered one of the higher-ranking officers.
Yes, sir,
answered two uniformed soldiers toting M4s. They re-entered the office through the front door, and the four of us huddled between the recycling bin and the trash dumpster to formulate an escape plan.
We can't just sit out here in the open, stated Evan as he sneaked another peek around the dumpster and into the parking lot. We're gonna have to hide somehow.
Agreed, I answered.
Easier said than done, however.
Donald quickly pointed out a stack of concrete vaults located near the back of the yard.
We can get Alex and Evan in one of those vaults that are stacked too high. Greg, you can squeeze into that steel casing over there. I'll go lay between the switch can on the pallets over there. Let's go quick. We don't have much time.
Alex and Evan scurried over to the stack of concrete vaults, and Evan started helping the pregnant Alex climb inside one of the second-level vaults. I made my way quickly over to the large steel casing that was laid across several cribbing blocks. The 2-inch thick steel casing was about 2 feet in diameter and probably 50 feet long. I crawled in somewhere near halfway to avoid being easily spotted by a passerby. Donald wedged himself in between the pallets of switch cans, concealing himself as best as he could. His feet could still be seen from the ground level below the pallets, which I could see myself from across the pathway inside my tubular steel sanctuary. We could all hear the door open leading from the office out onto the dock and the subsequent scuffing of boot heels on the gravel floor of the yard. The two soldiers systematically made their way through the maze of palletized line construction equipment without saying a word. I held my breath as I saw the four fatigued legs pace their way past the end of the steel casing in which I had taken refuge. They wandered past the pallets of switch cans where Donald was shrouded and around the aisle beyond the stacks of concrete vaults. They were out of my sight when a movement caught my eye beneath one of the line trucks parked to my left. Beneath the truck, just inside the rear axles, peering out from behind the dual tires were a set of spectacled eyes I could easily recognize even from that distance. It was Kenny. He must have had the same idea we did. Kenny was a project manager from a different department, but he spent a lot of time with our group because he had a personality that naturally gravitated to our group's chemistry. Kenny laid on his belly under the truck, his eyes locking on mine. He pursed his lips behind the index finger of his right hand. The two soldiers patrolled past the line truck without ever glancing in Kenny's or my direction. I exhaled out in relief as the two soldiers headed back up the steps, across the dock, and back into the office. We stayed hiding there for some time until the last of the M35s were loaded and rolled out of the parking lot. The biohazard quarantine vehicle and a few Humvees stormed out behind them. I slowly wriggled my way to the end of the steel casing and furled out onto the gravel. I struggled to my feet, checking first to my left and then to my right to make sure I hadn't been seen. I could see Donald stand up between the switch cans and then Kenny laboring his way out from under the line truck. We looked to our right and we could see Evan and Alex's heads protruding from above the lip of the concrete vault stacked at the end of the aisle. We scurried over to the base of the stacked vaults to assist in lowering Alex safely to the ground. Evan hopped over the lip of the vault, ninja rolling to his feet from the impact.
That was close,
exclaimed Evan.
Alex, you okay?
I think so,
she answered tentatively.
We gotta go. My little girl is waiting on me,
I interrupted, but Evan had a better point.
If things are as bad as they look, shouldn't we grab some shit from the storeroom before we hit the road? I mean, there's tools, water, all kinds of useful shit. And you really don't want to leave here just to have to come back because you don't have something you need, right? Where else are you gonna get this shit?
He asked.
I guess you do have a point, but this has got to happen fast. I can't leave her waiting.
Donald immediately pointed out that the truck under which Kenny had been hiding wasn't a line truck at all, but Timmy's maintenance truck. This truck had everything you could imagine on board already. It was built to remotely keep an entire fleet of vehicles on the road. What more could you ask for?
It was a small semi-truck with dual axles and boxes of every tool, from welding equipment to simple replacement parts for a large variety of late model trucks, SUVs, and cars. And it had a Davitt-style hoist and boom. Donald had made a very astute observation for sure by pointing out that truck, one that would prove to be huge if we were to survive what was to come.
Good call on that, Donald. You take that one. I'll try to find some keys for one of these other line trucks. We could use the booms on those for all kinds of shit.
Hey, guys,
interjected Evan.
There's hundreds of gallons of bottled water in the storeroom and in the office. It might be a good idea for us to grab that shit too while we're here, you know?
Let's hurry, I answered. We did just that. We began scavenging for vehicle keys, water jugs, oil, tools, and anything else readily available that we thought might be useful. The line trucks were perfect with all of their compartments and heavy load carrying capacities. It was really a blessing looking back that we were where we were when it all happened. Kenny headed to the Connex storage container where Timmy, the maintenance tech, stored all the oil, gas, and other spare parts for the fleet vehicles. As he threw the heavy door open to the trailer-style storage area, he made a startling discovery. The heavy steel doors groaned as he pulled them apart and clanged as they hit the side of the trailer, waking the sleeping beast within. Timmy hungrily lurched towards Kenny, snarling and foaming at the mouth like a rabid wolf, gnashing his teeth and swiping his arms about hysterically. Kenny quickly stepped back, putting some distance between himself and what was once his coworker.
No, not Timmy,
he muttered painfully, realizing the gravity of the situation. Timmy was a good old boy. He was kind of a backwoods hillbilly who reeked of moonshine and cheap cigarettes, but he could fix anything. It was pretty sad to see his seemingly empty body possessed by the carnal rage of a demonically controlled marionette. It wasn't long ago he was just a simple man making do with what he had. Now he was a tempestuous lunatic banefully threatening to tear Kenny's throat out.
Ah, shit,
exclaimed Kenny as he threw the doors to the Connex trailer closed and latched them shut. You could hear the mindless clamoring of Timmy's incarnated body thrashing about inside, but more importantly, well contained for the time being.
That sucks, gasped Kenny. I actually like that fucking guy.
Evan, Alex, and I proceeded to the stairs leading back up to the dock while Donald checked the line truck closest to the door for keys.
In here, got him,
he proclaimed as Evan hustled down the dock to the bed of the truck. Donald took the backpack he had been carrying off of his back and placed it onto the ground next to the truck. He tossed me the keys and began to open the compartment doors of the line truck to take a mental inventory of the contents within. No sooner than Donald got to the second compartment, the door to the storeroom burst open, and a rotund husk of a man stumbled out onto the dock. It was Bob, the storekeeper, or at least it was. He was drooling blood and saliva and sweating profusely. His eyes looked right through Evan as though he had no recognition of who was once a familiar friend.
Easy, big fella,
said Evan as he slowly retreated towards the line truck backed up to the dock.
Easy, easy.
Bob continued to viscerally lumber toward Evan as he backed into the truck bed. He was running out of room when Bob's eyes suddenly diverted to Alex. The expecting mother fearfully straggled backwards step by step as Bob's zombified shell changed directions and continued in shambling pursuit of her instead. Before anyone else could react, Donald grabbed his backpack off the ground and flung the empty arm strap over his head from the ground below the loading dock, catching Bob around the neck in a makeshift noose. He twisted the strap with the flick of his wrist and locked it in place, and used it to yank Bob's head downward, pinning it against the handrail. In one swift motion, he stuffed the barrel of his Colt Delta Elite 10mm pistol into Bob's foaming mouth and pulled the trigger. Alex wailed in horror as the contents of Bob's skull splattered against the cinder block wall behind the supply shelves.
Holy shit!
I exclaimed.
Forgot you carried that thing. I guess I always knew you'd show up here and start blasting people one day. I guess I just never thought I'd be relieved to see it happen.
I've been waiting a long time for the opportunity to do that,
he muttered.
Load this shit up and let's hit the road before things get any worse.
Evan threw open the storeroom door and hurried inside to gather what tools and supplies he could find. The storeroom was conveniently filled with Doomsday essentials like batteries, flashlights, tools, you name it. While Evan was looting what he could find from in there, Alex and I headed back into the office to start grabbing jugs of purified water. There was a rack just inside the door, and two more around the corner by the storm room. We rolled the contents of the first rack out onto the dock, and Donald began loading some of them onto each of the line trucks. I went down the stairs just inside the door and made a quick left towards the men's room where the second rack was positioned. Alex went around the corner to the right, past the coffee urns and the dispatch center, to the rack by Angel, the other admin's desk. As I was packing the jugs out onto the dock one by one, I distinctly remember the shrill cry for help as Alex encountered the two infected soldiers stationed at the door of the base manager's office. She backed up to the sliding window in front of Angel's desk, with nowhere else to go. She frantically kicked the remaining water jugs towards the lumbering soldiers to deter their pursuit. The door to the base manager's office creaked open, and the empty body of Jim Flowers, the one-time base manager, slowly stumbled into the hallway behind the soldiers. I ran as fast as I could around the corner past the dispatch center and skidded to a stop between Alex and the infected trio. I looked in every direction for something to use as a weapon but came up with nothing as they systematically bore down onto the two of us. I covered Alex with as much of myself as I could, preparing for the worst, and then I took my hands away from my head to see Thaddeus standing in front of us. Thaddeus, the general foreman of our work group, stood all of 5'6" tall, but yet was as intimidating of a man as you might ever encounter. He was soft-spoken, kind, and helpful, but the kind of guy you knew you didn't want to cross. He was a true badass, plain and simple. He was a hunter, a survivalist, a worker, and a father. He was a man I had always admired, but I had never been more grateful to see him than I was now.
"What the hell are you still doing here?"
he questioned.
"Trying to get some shit and get out of here, you?" "I was on my way back from Kent and I heard all the shit going down on the radio. Thought I would check in,"
he answered.
"Where's everybody else?"
"Not good, Thad. They're all at the fairgrounds or, well, worse."
"Go into the storeroom, grab some radios,"
he instructed.
"That way we can all keep in touch. There are charging stations in there too. We'll need those."
He tossed the two M4s that were dangling by the straps from the necks of the freshly executed soldiers in my direction.
"You're probably going to want these,"
he said as he tucked the .45 back under his belt. While Thad and Alex loaded the rest of the water jugs into the trucks, I headed into the storeroom to assist Evan and to grab the radios as Thad had suggested. I tossed Evan one of the two M4s we commandeered from the dead soldiers. We grabbed the last of what we might need from in there and worked our way back towards the dock. As I passed Bob's abandoned desk, something caught my eye. It was an instructional training DVD for safely dispensing propane. I considered the propane standalone generator I had just installed on my home and thought to myself, "Fuck it, you never know." I snatched the DVD and headed out the door back onto the dock. I flung the contents of my storeroom pillage into the passenger seat of the line truck Donald had secured for me, and he handed me the keys. All in all, we had a good haul of equipment and vehicles. Thad had his Ford F-350 loaded up with water and tools. Donald had Timmy's fleet maintenance semi, also loaded with water and tools. I had a line truck with a boom hoist and an auger loaded with water and tools, and Evan had the same. We were all well loaded up, each with a various assortment of batteries, radios, and charging stations. We also had the radios installed in the line trucks. Not to mention, the line trucks were bearing the logo of the local utility, so we might be able to fly under the National Guard's radar, as they might mistake us for the last few people trying to maintain the utility infrastructure. Things might not have been going well compared to a normal day at the office, but compared to everyone else, we were pretty well off. I turned the keys to start the truck and hopped back out onto the pavement to make one last huddle with my group. "Thad, I assume you're heading back to Oley to get your wife. Evan, get Alex home to Manuel, and as soon as you get to your dad's place, radio in to let us know you made it. Kenny, good luck, and let us know if your family's safe once you get home. Donald and I are headed across the bridge back to the peninsula. We'll let you know what we find as soon as we get there." I trailed off. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I may never see any of them again. There were a few moments of awkward silence as we all must have been thinking the same thing. Then, like nothing had ever happened, the taciturn Thaddeus jumped into the cab of his truck and motioned for all of us to do the same. I was the first in the convoy headed towards the electronic gate of the supply yard. As I approached the gate, I mashed the pedal to the floor, accelerating the huge truck towards the chain-link entryway. I grabbed the next gear, and just like a scene from an action movie, the gate exploded as I pounded through it and out into the parking lot. No sooner than the flailing pieces of what once had been the gate came to rest in the parking lot outside the office, I heard the familiar voice of Thaddeus over the radio.
What the hell? If you just stop at the line and wait, the gate'll open for you.
I know, I replied. I've just always wanted to do that.
10-4,
he responded.
Be careful.
We pulled out of the parking lot, single file onto Milwaukee Avenue. Donald and I made a right-hand turn towards Tacoma and eventually the peninsula, and Kenny, Alex, and Evan followed Thaddeus to the left towards Olympia and Puyallup. I wasn't sure if we would ever see each other again, but my thoughts quickly turned to the task at hand, which was getting to my daughter and then home to my wife. Thank you for joining us for Awakened Chapter 1. Stay tuned. Chapter 2.